in the canteen down at Columbine, with the
rags they never found, striking
matches up at
Waco
when they
burnt it
to the ground. Without me,
Oklahoma
wasn't
possible
at all.
See my silhouette
in the Super 8
around the
grassy knoll.
KABU wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KABU reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KABU's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KABU.
We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island.
KABU and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Old Rockin' Chair's got me.
Old Rockin' Chair got your father.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what we got coming up for you this morning. Political Perspectives is up first. We'll hear economic update with host Richard Wolf. He has updates on the minimum wage in Europe versus the United States, the richest U.S. families, and the economics of immigration. And he speaks with Tom Sikouros, author of Checking the Banks, The Nuts and Bolts of Banking for People Who Want to Fix It. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15 on Flashpoints, journalist and author Vijay Prashad discusses the Israeli-Egyptian ceasefire fakeout and the real politics behind the latest U.S.-supported Israeli bombing in Gaza. Also more on the corporate media's pro-Israeli reporting. At 11 o'clock on The Food Show, Paul Greenberg talks about his book American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, also food and wine stories from Chehalem Valley winemakers. And Ryan Drum of Island Herbs talks about seaweed and radiation. Thanks for listening to KABU, and thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. As always, if you're not a KABU member, you can easily become one by going to kabu.fm. And now we'll go right to Political Perspectives, our show today, economic update with your host, Richard Wolf.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, national, local, global, that shape our jobs, our incomes, our debts, all the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolf, I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. Currently, I teach at the New School University in New York City. And I also write economic columns for a variety of publications, but especially for truthout.org. That is a courageous, independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to check out at truthout.org. If you're interested in the kinds of analysis we offer on this program, in the guests we have, such as the one I will introduce a little bit later, in the kinds of news that we bring to your attention, then please make use of the two websites we maintain. They are available to you without any charge, 24/7. The first is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of these websites also will allow you to communicate with us, to say to us what you like and don't like about the program, what you'd like to see us cover, and even to ask us questions. We get many more of those than we can answer, but we select some and we respond to them towards the end of every program. We ask you to bear with us that we can't answer everything, but we do make an effort and we do read every one of your communications, and that helps us design each program that we present. And finally, both websites allow you to click on an icon and follow us more closely, Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest in particular. And we ask that you do that because it's a way to keep up on a more ongoing basis with what we do. Well, I want to begin today by a couple of little things left over from last week. I want to thank the person who wrote in to correct me. I had given you a number of the people who are considered ultra-high net worth individuals. Let me remind those of you who weren't there last week what that is. Big brokerage houses and big wealth management companies keep track of something called an ultra-high net worth individual. This is a person who has liquid assets worth $30 million or more. That is bank accounts, stocks, and bond holdings of $30 million or more. Sadly, I am not among the ultra-high net worth individuals, and my guess is that my guest today is likewise in that sad situation. I mistakenly said there were 128,000 of those people around the world. That was in error. It's 199,000 as of last year, so I wanted to correct it. That's right, 199,000 people around the world out of a population in the billions in this planet, a tiny fraction, I worked it out, 0.0003 precisely of the world is in that situation. But together they own trillions. And we'll come back to this whole inequality issue several times as we go through today's program. Second, many of you have asked me if there's a book you can read about how the politics of America have been corrupted by money. And actually, there's quite a few books, but a recent one that came to my attention is well written and full of information, so I wanted to recommend it to you, that's all. The book's title is Big Money, easy to remember. The author is Kenneth P. Vogel, V-O-G-E-L. Big Money by Kenneth Vogel. There you will learn more than you'll want to know about exactly how big money controls, shapes, and buys the American political system. And finally, left over from last week, we discussed the Supreme Court decision regarding the Hobby Lobby Corporation. If you will remember, Hobby Lobby doesn't want to pay for birth control and abortion and so forth for its employees, went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which decided in a close vote that because they have these deep religious commitments that they spoke about, they should not be made to pay, so that their freedom of religion trumps the freedom of their employees to get coverage for the medical needs that they have. I made the point then that there was a bit of a contradiction here, since Hobby Lobby does a great deal of business with the People's Republic of China, which is officially in favor of abortion, in favor of birth control. They seem to have no problem making money off of their relationship with China, notwithstanding their religious scruples. This caused one of you to let me know that there's another dimension here, namely that Hobby Lobby maintains a 401k pension fund for their employees. They control the investments of that pension fund, and those investments include many of the companies who make birth control and other equipment for that need in our society. It raises the question of whether religion is even the real issue here, or whether religion is a convenient way for companies to save money that they can't do any other way, and so they've found their way to this. If so, then it might lead folks with genuine religious commitments to wonder exactly who they're allied with. Let me turn now to our updates for today and begin with a remarkable story. 30 years ago, two guys in Madison, Wisconsin, started a tiny sandwich shop, which they called Zingerman's. I don't exactly know why, since neither of them is named Zingerman, but they did. And they decided after a while to run their business in a very different way. They gave their workers an enormous amount of influence and say in all the basic decisions of the company. They didn't make the workers into a co-op. They didn't give them control in the end of the enterprise, but they gave them a wildly unusual amount of real, genuine influence. So the question is, does this make it difficult for a company? Does it make it harder for a company in a capitalist economic system to compete if it allows its workers a real amount of influence and say over basic decisions? The answer is unambiguously no, but because I know that many of you may not yet be convinced, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about Zingerman's. And I learned about it a few days ago from the New York Times, which would be an unusual place normally to find information of this sort. Here's the story. Over three decades, Zingerman's went from a small sandwich shop with two people to a large collection of nine distinct businesses in the Madison, Wisconsin area that today employ 650 people and have annual revenue of $50 million. In short, over the last 30 years, which have been a very hard time for small businesses generally across the United States, a business specifically organized around the notion of massive worker participation, far beyond what is typical in any capitalist enterprise, has done way better than most. Can such enterprises compete in our economic system? You bet. And there's a story of one who did it real well. Second, I wanted to talk to you about how, in the last week or so, two countries in Europe did something remarkable around their minimum wage. And since we're struggling over minimum wages here in the United States, I thought this would be a good topic to bring to your attention. Germany has never had a legal minimum wage until now. They just passed it for the first time. One of the reasons Germany didn't need and want a minimum wage was because the German economy is very well regulated by a combination of a highly organized business community, a highly organized trade union and labor union community, and a well-organized government. And the three of them sit down, and basically the government is kept out for as long as the businesses and the unions can work things out. And businesses and unions have worked out a de facto minimum wage for generations. But now, for many reasons, everybody decided it's time to have a minimum wage legally binding. And so the parliament in Germany has passed it. Angela Merkel, the government top executive in that society, chancellor she's called, will sign it. So what is it? I thought you'd be interested. The minimum wage in Germany is about $11.25 when translated into American money. So let's keep it clear. Here in our country, the minimum wage is barely over $7. So the Germans have set a minimum wage at over $11. The president of the United States, Barack Obama, is on record as supporting a minimum wage of $10.10, which is what he thinks is fair. But it is widely recognized that given the nature of the Republican control of the House of Representatives, he's not going to get a $10.10 minimum wage anytime soon. Let me continue. Over the last week, the British government raised the minimum wage there so that it is now also over $11 an hour. Okay, that's two and counting. Germany and Britain, Perhaps the two largest economies in Europe have a minimum wage more than 50% higher than what we pay in the United States. Last week, and this got a lot of you to communicate to me, I also informed you what the minimum wage was in Denmark, namely $20.30 an hour. Well, let me finish it off with Switzerland, that little mountain country famous for chocolate and watches and things like that. They recently had a ballot issue that all Swiss voters voted on to raise the minimum wage there to $25 an hour. That ballot initiative was defeated, but not by a lot, and it will be on the ballot again. So I ask you to consider what it might mean about the economic system of the United States if Switzerland is dealing with $25 an hour, Denmark already has $20.30 an hour, and Britain and Germany are over $11 an hour, and we're still paying our people $7 and change for an hour of their labor. It ought to make you think about something. At the other end of the extreme, let's talk about America's richest. Forbes magazine, which is one of the major magazines of, by, and for the business community in the United States, has its current issue devoted to, I quote, America's richest families. So if you're interested in who they are and how much they have and what they're like, get a copy of Forbes. I wouldn't recommend it in general, but for this purpose, it's a good piece of work. And I thought I'd discuss a little bit the richest family in America. Many of you will know and will not be surprised. First of all, let me tell you the big statistics. There are 185 richest families in America who together have $1.2 trillion worth of assets. The richest among them is the Walton family. The Walton family, named after Sam Walton, who was the person who started, together with some members of his family, the company we now know as Walmart. If I've read the story correctly in Forbes, the Walton family has inherited, the current ones, the wealth created by the initial two brothers who both have passed away. The Walton family controls 51% of the shares of Walmart, and so that means that they are the owners as a family, and I believe it's now seven people that are the ones in question, who own this corporation that last year had $476 billion in revenue. These numbers are mind-boggling, but I wanted you to know them. And I wanted you to get to know particularly one of them. She is the richest woman probably in the world. Her name is Christy Walton. She is the widow of one of the other Waltons. So she is the richest woman in the world in the way that a great many of the richest people in the world become that way, by inheritance. She didn't do it. She inherited it. How did she do? Well, she's a 59-year-old woman. She lives in Jackson, Wyoming. She's the widow of John Walton. Her dividends, just from her Walton stock, and she has lots of other stock, but her dividends from Walton stock, Walmart stock last year, came to $460 million. In other words, every day of the year, 7 days a week, she earned from her stock, because of her inheritance, $1.33 million. Every day she earned, she doesn't buy lottery tickets because she wins the lottery every day. Every day. How does this work? What are the economics here? I'm not going to discuss the morality, just the economics. Walmart is the largest private employer in the United States. It has over 1 million employees. That means there are millions in the United States, or at least 1 million, of people who go to work 5 days a week, who put in a whole bunch of hours. Together, they do what Walmart does. And what Walmart does is classic merchant behavior. It buys stuff at one price, and it resells it to you at a higher price, and it gets the difference. That's what Walmart is. They don't manufacture things. They don't produce. They sell and buy, and they pick up the difference. And these million people come in there and work. They load up the shelves. They clean up the place. They gather the carts. They do the work you have to do to run a business in a mall. And they put in lots of hours. Walmart workers are among the lowest paid workers in our society. They've recently had strikes and demonstrations because they're paid so poorly. They're provided with very poor medical care. Many of them, as I've reported to you, have to go and rely on public assistance in the United States because they're paid so poorly. But the work they do does produce a lot of wealth. They don't get it. But now you know who does. The shareholders of Walmart. So Christy Walton, I bear her no animus whatsoever, never met her. She doesn't know me. I don't know her. This has nothing to do with her personally. But Christy Walton collects $1.3 million a day, 7 days a week, which is the wealth produced by people who have to go on Medicaid to support themselves and their health because they work full-time, part-time at Walmart and don't get paid enough even to take care of their medical bills. So it's not just that some people are wealthy. And it's important to understand how the wealth of some is the poverty of others. All right, enough for my shorter updates. It's now time for me to introduce my guest for today. He is Tom Seguros. He comes to us from Rhode Island. He is the author of this book, Checking the Banks, about which we will talk a little bit later. First, let me tell you a little bit about Tom. He's a freelance public policy analyst, engineer, and writer. He has worked and run for office, I learned, in his home state of Rhode Island. In 1991, he became a banking analyst in a hurry. Basically, it was because the problems of his state were becoming so severe, although, of course, they became even more severe once the crisis of 2007 hit. Some of you may remember that I have reported on some cities in Rhode Island that have had to declare bankruptcy and have been important in shaping the struggles over public pensions and other issues. He has become a kind of self-taught expert on banking, so well-versed in it that he has consulted dozens of elected officials, candidates, and activists, not only in his native Rhode Island, but also in Pennsylvania, California, Vermont, and elsewhere around the country. So it's a great pleasure, Tom, to welcome you to this program and to give our listeners and viewers a chance to hear what you have to say about the banking system.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So let's jump right in. On page 159 of your book, Checking the Banks, you write, quote, "Our nation desperately needs a new set of financial institutions." Well, that leads me to ask the obvious question. Tell us what you think is wrong with the financial institutions, above all the banks, that we have now.
What's the matter with the banks that we have now? You mean beside the fact that they melted down the economy in 2008? Or do you mean beside the fact that they routinely steal hundreds of millions of dollars from our cities and towns? Or do you mean beside the part about how they promote predatory financial products that actually serve to make people worse off than before? Or is there something else that you're getting at?
Well, you left out the admitted money laundering, crooked money that they knew they were drawing in to make money off of it and thereby helping drug lords and all the other folks whose money they've laundered.
Yeah, you're right. How could I have overlooked that? That's really unconscionable.
Let's talk a little bit about how things got this way. I mean, how is it possible for me, in program after program, to detail the misdeeds of the banks, for the newspapers and media to be full of it, for the banks to have now paid hundreds of millions of dollars in the fines that they had to pay when they were caught and admitted in many cases that they had done everything from setting interest rates in the LIBOR scandal in Europe to all the things you just listed. How did we get a set of institutions about whom such a thing as we've just said could be said?
How is that? How did that happen?
It's a little hard to see, but I think that what happened is that they became detached from any feeling of responsibility to the communities that they exist in. They felt somehow that growth was more important, and the whole industry, I think, is infected by this kind of by the sort of economic ethos that says that so long as everybody just looks out for themselves, then it all works out fine in the end. And so what you have is people who defend their actions based on the idea of the invisible hand and all of that stuff, when what is actually happening is that they are driving us all to the brink of ruin. But the problem now is that the people who understand the world that way, they've gone and built institutions that are so large and are so integral to the work that everybody does in the economy, that it's very hard to see how to rein them in. And so you have this situation that is destructive but stable, and that's a hard thing to do, it's a hard thing to know how to deal with that. I mean, what I see as the way to go forward with this is to say, all right, there, you know, we have this landscape of financial institutions that are unaccountable where they're not actually destructive. What do you do about that? One possible thing that you can do is seek to regulate them better. And my hat is off to the people who are doing that work. There are lots of good people doing that work. Dodd-Frank is a meager beginning, but it's working out a little bit better than people thought. That's fine. Another thing we can do is recognize that the money that these banks are using to do this stuff is our money. And if we choose to do so, we could foster the creation of other financial institutions, things that might have community responsibility baked into them from the beginning, things that might have regard for their customers as part of their mission rather than as something that is easily discarded. We can do that because ultimately it is our money that they've got. And we can withdraw it and foster the creation of these other institutions. And that, I think, is a track of financial reform that is widely overlooked and that I think more people ought to be looking at.
So have I understood you correctly? You're saying that we're stuck with institutions that are not only dysfunctional in the sense that they've brought us vast amounts of grief and difficulty and crises literally of the ability of our system to continue, but that in the process they've become so enormous. And as a footnote, let me remind everyone that at the height of the crisis in 2007 and 2008, there was a lot of talk about banks being too big to fail. And the list of banks that were too big to fail, if you made that list now, are bigger now than they were at the time when we were discussing it.
Exactly.
Meaning that whatever the regulations thought they were doing or sought to do, they haven't been able to do it. And so we're stuck with them. But that somehow your idea is whatever we try to do with regulation, we really have to go in another direction of setting up new and different institutions.
Right. Well, so Bank of America is too big to fail. One thing that we could do is withdraw money from it. Right, but then the question is, okay, we'll withdraw money and do what with it? And this is a serious question. So an example is that all the states, all the municipalities, all the states and the counties and the cities in the country have their money in banks like Bank of America or J.P. Morgan, and part of the reason is that there are technical rules that prevent them from patronizing smaller banks. But there are ways around those rules, not circumventing them, but creating structures that accommodate those rules that allow them to patronize smaller banks. So with a city in Pennsylvania, I worked last year to construct a financial institution that would take the city's deposits, essentially act as the city's bank, but rather than put all the money in Bank of America or Wells Fargo or one of the big banks, it would distribute it to the little banks that actually care about the downtown of that city. And that's a new structure. So that's a way that they can move their money out of the big banks and into the little ones, strengthening their community, strengthening the credit markets that they actually care about, rather than taking their deposits and having them finance, you know, construction projects in Abu Dhabi and things like that.
Is that pretty close to the classic example that we've talked about on this program of the Bank of North Dakota, in the sense of a bank that uses the public's money in ways that the public supports by not using the big bank, setting up its own bank?
Yeah, I mean, the Bank of North Dakota is an excellent example of a place where the state acknowledges that it has the financial resources to insist that its banking business be done in a better way. You know, the state of I don't know what the state of New York's budget is. The state of Rhode Island has an $8 billion budget every year. They spend $8 billion every year. At any one time, they have assets on hand of around $1 billion. If you had that kind of money, right, you would not be just a customer of a bank. You would insist on service that was way better than the state gets from the banks that it deals with. You just would not tolerate what goes on.
Right.
And what I'm saying,
you'd be a prized customer of that bank, and they'd be running around trying to figure out how to keep you.
They would do exactly what you want, right? Yes. But instead, what you have this like learned passivity of all these states and cities and counties that feel they have no option except to just be customers. And North Dakota, to their credit, 95 years ago, they insisted that they would do it differently. And they did. They established something that allows their bank allows their state to get its banking done in a way that serves the state, rather than pretending to serve the state by actually serving the managers of the banks that are pretending to serve the state. You know that. So
I'm struck, just as a footnote, so I want everyone to know it, that over the last 95 years that the Bank of North Dakota has been in existence, conservatives inside the state and the big commercial private banks outside have done everything they could to get rid of that. It's the only state in the union has that.
No, actually, that's not quite true. It's a funnier story than that. It was founded by radicals, right? It was created as part of the progressive populist movement of the upper
of
Midwest that got us William Jennings Bryan and Robert LaFollette and all of that. But it was very divisive when it happened. But the radicals got it through, they got it passed, they raised the money to establish the bank. But in the process, they also lost the governorship, they lost the state house. But they got the thing established. And so what happened was the people who insisted that this was all communism and they came into office, the thing was already there, and they came into office vowing to eliminate it. And then they looked at it and thought, wow, this could be useful. And then they started running it.
Yeah.
And so the administration of it has gone back and forth from conservative to less so ever since then. But you know, the way this works is a radical plus 20 years, that's the establishment, right? And so you have this radical idea, and it has been completely thoroughly assimilated into the very conservative establishment of the state of North Dakota. So one of their senators now, his start in politics was as the president of the Bank of North Dakota.
Right. No, I'm just struck that this idea, once it was shown that it could really make a difference in the state of North Dakota, when they were confronted with, well, should we get rid of it and be like the other 49 states?
Yeah.
No, thank you. And
exactly.
Today, if I'm informed correctly, no serious politician in North Dakota, left, right, or center, says boo about the Bank of North Dakota, basically
saying
this is now, you know, like the proverbial apple pie and baseball. It's part of American culture, and it's something that everybody in North Dakota wants,
even though
it is a direct alternative to private banking.
Although part of what has happened to it is that what they do a lot is sort of shore up private
local
banks,
right?
They take they see a small local bank that has a customer who needs a $2 million line of credit. That bank doesn't feel good about offering that much. The Bank of North Dakota is behind them to say, well, we'll do half of it, and you do half of it. And you know, the North Dakota bank, it doesn't do direct service to the customers. It does it through these other banks, and so it's actually turned out to be a mainstay. I mean, a real prop to these smaller banks. And when you look at the credit markets in North Dakota and compare it to neighboring states, they have a lot more healthier, smaller banks, and they have businesses who can get the credit that they need. It has worked for them.
Well, I want to remind you again that if these kinds of programs are of interest, please make use of our two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info, where you can follow this kind of information, get more of this kind of information, communicate to us about the program, and also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Tom, to pick up on our conversation, there's a political powerhouse in what you're saying. I mean, the classic political divide in capitalist economies was not only between the capitalists and the workers, but also between big business and small business. And in many countries, the way the politics shaped out was the big businesses and the labor were at loggerheads. And the question often was, which way would the small business community go politically? Would they feel more of an identity of interest with big business and so become a bloc with them? Or would they feel more of an identity as the enemy of big business, making an alliance with working people? And we've had that in the United States too. It sounds to me like the Bank of North Dakota and other efforts like that, if they were made in cities and towns, to be similar, to have, for example, public money be funneled to smaller local private banks that care about the local development rather than the big ones, that what we're seeing here is the economics of more of an alliance of small business and the average person, in which the big businesses are the enemy. Because if we were to follow the notion of let's pull the money of any town out of Bank America and give it to a local autonomous, that's
right.
That's bad for Bank America. It's good for the local banks and it's good for the local people, but it's not so good for Bank of America. How's that going to get resolved?
Well, I think that essentially what the goal is, essentially what my goal is to say, look, cities and towns, municipalities, and us collectively, we have a lot more clout. We could have a lot more clout in the credit markets than we feel we do now. And the goal is to find ways to exercise that clout. You know, to say, this is what we want, and here's a structure that is going to allow us to insist that we get it. And you know, the truth is that I definitely see the split that you're saying, and I think that it's a very real one, and it is one that, you know, the conflict between the small operators and the larger one, it's one that I think could provide some constructive ways forward in politics. But more what I'm after is I want the credit markets to work well. I want the businesses to have the credit that they need to grow. You know, in over almost every state in the country, every city of any size, every county has some kind of economic development agency, right? You know, why do those exist everywhere? You know, they're universal, and the reason they exist everywhere is because credit markets don't work. Because everywhere you go, you can find businesses that deserve credit, that are solid businesses, but are not served by the local credit markets. And so what happens is that these businesses wind up with enough political clout to insist that something be done, and so then something is done. And you know, and sometimes it winds up being corrupt and going wrong. But a lot of times it's doing good work. I think that what is happening is that all those communities are essentially voting with their feet and saying, look, the credit markets are not doing what we need, but rather than back up a step and say, look, how do we achieve the clout to insist that banks do what they want, we're going to create this little tiny thing that's going to supply some of the needs. What I want them to do is to step back and say, look, we have the clout. Let's make something happen. Let's, and it could be for, it could be to enhance credit to local businesses. It could be a city saying something like, you know, our residents are getting ripped off by these payday lenders who are charging 290% annual interest or 400% annual interest. Or it could be, we feel that our city or our state is being ripped off by these crazy bond deals, these crazy financial engineering. I call it predatory public finance. You know, so there are different reasons why a community might want to exercise that clout, but they're all valid. They're all valid reasons. They might lead to different solutions, but they are all ways to move the ball forward, and you know, try to create institutions that actually have community responsibility and you know, and some democracy baked into them from the very beginning.
Right, and the idea I think behind this is really simple. If you want a major economic institution like the credit system to serve democratically the mass of people, and the mass of people are working people and dozens of small businesses, then you have to, as you put it, structurally embed the people who are supposed to benefit in the institution's working.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're not going to get it. If you leave the credit system controlled overwhelmingly by 25 enormous banks, driven by what their shareholders want, driven by the profit mm-hmm. system of the country, driven by their competition with banks in other parts right. of the world, etc., then you can't be surprised if the decisions they make serve the objectives they are governed right. by right. and leave short shrift for the average person in the small business who are, after all, only powerful in the way you say, if they're brought together, if they're organized. We have the numbers. Small businesses are larger than the big ones. If you put them together,
right.
the mass of people's money, even though it's a little for each one, together is a huge amount of money, et cetera, et cetera. But that would have to be organized to become effective.
Right, and there's another technical problem too, which is actually what the book is intended to address. And the technical problem is that banking is filled with jargon and technical minutia, and it's a very imposing, it's a very intimidating field for lay people to walk into. And so people who know that something's wrong, who know that they're being ripped off, or know that their city is being ripped off, don't often have the language to say, because you know, because people who spend their lives thinking about banking, you know, they tend to be bankers, and like most of them are pretty happy with the system. It's theirs, you know. So when you go to them and say, well, how can we fix it? They're like, fix
what's
what?
Wrong? That's
yeah,
right.
And so what the book is about is sort of a primer, an introduction to banking in a hopefully sort of non-threatening way, so that the people who do perceive the unfairness of the system have the language to insist that it be done in a better way.
By the way, you're a modest fellow, so let me be the one to be immodest. This book, which I've read, Checking the Banks, has a subtitle. I'm going to read it to you. The Nuts and Bolts of Banking for People Who Want to Fix It. That's really what this book is. It's exactly what Tom just said. It teaches you a great deal about how banks work, step by step, simple, clear English, a short book, so you're not going to, you know, it's not an encyclopedia. This is a way to become able to think critically and to act to make a difference in your community. And so it's a very practically useful book, as well as offering a kind of insight. As we wind this down, let me ask you some huge questions, you know, the kind that these programs dwell in. I think of credit and money as one of the basic pillars of any economic system, at least in the modern times. So what is it like? Well, it's like the rivers and the coastline of a country. I mean, everything depends on that. The goods that come in, the goods that go out, the transportation. I mean, and we here in the United States, as indeed in most countries, we do not give our rivers and coastline to private enterprises driven by profit. We insist that they be managed in some sense for the general welfare, for the general good of all of us who have to, whether we're businesses or individuals, large or small, we all need the rivers. We all need what the rivers provide and what the coastline provides, what the big, our Great Lakes provide, and so on. Those are public things. Likewise, we believe that we need military security and public safety in our streets, so we have our army and police forces, and we try basically not to have those be private enterprises driven by money making, but rather to be institutions responsible to us as a people to take care of the general welfare.
And if I can leap in, because I think I know where you're going with this. I mean, the financial industry creates nothing. The financial industry was invented to facilitate
everybody else's labor.
The business of actually making stuff that we need, of growing food that we need, of repairing things, building machines that we need,
erecting our homes.
I mean, the financial industry was created to facilitate that, but it has morphed into something far more than that. It has morphed into an end of its own, and that I think ultimately is a fairly destructive kind of a thing, because you have these people who are inventing things for the sake of not making anything better. They're inventing things for the sake of making themselves wealthier, and that I think is fundamentally at odds with the business of growing good food and building interesting things and building a useful and happy society. So I agree completely that finance is something that we all depend on, and to a certain extent, I want it to be almost like almost as unexceptional as a utility. I mean, I think
a public park that we all have access to,
right,
and that is kept beautiful so our children can have a picnic.
We'll know that banking reform has worked when banking is boring. And you know, in a sense, my goal here is to facilitate the creation of institutions that are dull, you know, that are just day-to-day doing the work that we need in an unexceptional, unflashy kind of a way. You know, a friend of mine who was involved in trying to organize a mutual bank some time ago, this is a bank that's owned by its depositors. It's sort of like a credit union, but
we used to have a lot of those in the United States.
Yeah, we used to have a lot. We haven't had any for a long time. It's still possible to found one. But my friend said, well, you know, the reason nobody does it anymore is that nobody gets rich with a mutual bank. And, you know, in the software industry, they say, well, is that a bug or is it a feature?
Yes.
And this is a place where I think, you know, that's a feature. And if you could get our collective wealth, the wealth of cities and towns behind establishing institutions that had features like that were just boring, then I think we would all be a lot better off.
I mean, amen is all I can say. I would add only two things. Where I was going with that is we've now had a chance to see. It's not just a hypothetical, you know, why don't we have banking one way rather than another? We've had banking that is overwhelmingly private now for quite a while. We see what it can do and we see what it costs. And it seems to me that if we had a public institution that worked as badly, caused as many crises as that, we would long ago have had a demand in our society to stop giving the government a role there and give it over to private enterprise because the government hasn't done it properly. Okay, if we're going to have that kind of reasoning, then we ought to run it the other way as well. And it's not an argument to have the big fat federal government, but banking by its nature is all about local money coming in and local credit being provided. Let's make it a local phenomenon. Let's have the customers and the workers in the bank together run a cooperative enterprise that serves the local people. In many ways, it would be an important experiment to do that across the United States. And let's see how they work. Let's see how people feel about them. Maybe the rest of the country will develop the same affection for this kind of a bank that the people of North Dakota have developed for their public bank. These are things that a serious response to our financial crisis would entail, it seems to me, and that your work helps us to figure out how to do it, as well as to understand better why it's necessary.
The cities and states and counties across the country control something a little bit less than $1 trillion worth of deposits. So in a large sense, some of those too big to fail banks are supported by
absolutely
by us. And so I agree completely. If you had an institution that acted as badly as that, there would be calls for reform. Well, the fact is that we do have an institution that, and that's the part of those banks that is supported by these government deposits. We can demand better service. We can demand better institutions, and our governments can create them if the will is there.
And I also think we know that there are millions of our fellow Americans who have, in a sense, voted with their feet in a small way. Mm-hmm. They pull their money out of those big banks and rely on credit unions, which are small efforts all around the country that, that deserve to be understood not as a solution, but as already a sign of the kind of massive support Americans are ready to give to an alternative institution that is much more responsive to the people that it serves than a private profit-driven bank.
Yep. There,
Tom, I wish I could do more. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Time dictates, and we don't have too much. So let me turn finally to responding to some of your questions. One of the questions that came this last week was by a person very critical of what she's noticed, which is namely that many public service institutions, many charities, have leaders, CEOs, that get enormously high pay. She's very distressed. $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $1 million, $2 million for someone administering a charity based, for example, on donations, and therefore raising the question, really, do the people who donate to this particular charity, I'm not going to mention any names, although I surely could, do they really want that to be how their money is used to pay these high salaries? And she asks, is this reasonable and why does it exist? I'm not going to say it's reasonable. For me, all of these kinds of salaries, whether they're in the private sector or in public service or in the charity or the nonprofit sector, are unacceptable economically, politically, morally, ethically, you name it. They oughtn't to exist. There's really no justification for it. But I do want to explain where it comes from. Back in the 1970s, the average CEO of a private profit-making capitalist enterprises earned in the neighborhood of 40 times what an average worker did. Today, 30, 40 years later, that ratio is 2 to 300 to 1, not 40 to 1. In other words, the great change of the last 30 or 40 years has been in the relationship between the private enterprise CEOs and the average workers. Nor is there the slightest mystery about this. Over the last 30 or 40 years, the productivity of American workers, how much in the way of goods and service each worker produces in an hour of his or her time, has gone steadily up. But the wage, what the employer gives to the worker, has since the late 1970s been essentially flat. That's right. The real wage, that is, if you adjust the money that a worker gets per hour for the prices he or she has to pay, is no different today than what it was in 1978. So here's the solution. Here's the end result. If what the worker gives the employer, productivity measures that, goes up every year for 40 years, but what the employer gives the worker, the wage, is flat, the profits for the employer are going to go crazy, which they have in the last 30 or 40 years. That's why we had the long stock market boom. That's why we had the bubbles punctuating that boom. And one of the things that was done with those profits by the heads of the corporations who sat there enjoying rising productivity of their workers without having to pay them anymore, one of the things those executives did, surprise, surprise, was give themselves enormous increases in pay. What you're seeing in the nonprofit sector is a late copycat phenomena. It's become the norm. It's become socially acceptable. We see how the rich and famous live. We see what kind of pay packages the big executives give themselves. Are we really surprised that someone who chooses to call himself or herself a CEO, the same name as comes from the business world, wants also to live in the universe of these pay? If we want to stop having the nonprofits give themselves overdone executive salaries, I think it has to start where it all began. And that is in the sector of the private economy, where corporations who were successful in no longer raising their workers' wages took that opportunity to jack up their executives' salaries and pay packages. Second thing I want to talk about, many of you wrote to me about, is immigration. There's been a scandal, as many of you I'm sure know, over recent weeks, particularly having to do with children coming up from Central and Latin America and trying to get into the United States, often on their own, dying along the way, being abused along the way, and arriving in the United States only then to be sent back. And all kinds of politicians have weighed in on this, conservatives trying to ride the anxiety of Americans about immigrants, others trying to make this out to be a purely moral question, and so on. I want, because this is a program about economics, to talk about the economics. Earlier in this program, we talked about how the economic system that we have has produced the extremes of Walmart's underpaid million employees alongside the Walton family as the richest family, perhaps, on this planet, disposing of maybe 7 or 8 people, disposing of $150 billion, mind-bending inequality. This system produces that. But this same system produces immigration. Let me explain how that works. One of the things that has shaped Latin America over the last 20 years happens to have something to do with Walmart. The United States has written trade agreements, NAFTA with Mexico, but other trade agreements with Central America. Those allow American corporations to move in. Typical are trading companies like Walmart, not the only one, but like Walmart. They come in and they set up stores. And that destroys the livelihood of little shopkeepers who used to be the ones who bought the rice and sold it in the local community, who bought the pots and pans and sold it in the local community. Now there's a Walmart or something like it, and it disorients the local community, deprives millions of people of their jobs. It reorganizes the economy in all kinds of ways. Nothing is done to help the mass of people displaced by these arrangements. They're profitable for Walmart and the big American companies that move in. They're often profitable for local companies in the countries where they arrive. You might call them the junior partners of the big guys from Europe and America and Japan and China now that come in. But it's a disruption of the economic relationships that causes poverty, loss of work, desperation, gangs among young people who can't find a job. In fact, it causes so much disruption in these countries that many of the people make the wrenching personal decision to leave their home, to leave their family, to leave their community, to leave their church, to leave their everything they know and make an extremely long, dangerous trip to another country they don't know, which requires a language they don't speak and gives them a job that is very poor, but it at least is better than what's happening. The whole process, then, is part of an economic development. We allow that development to benefit the United States' corporations at the expense of many conditions for many people in the third world. And then we're surprised they want to come here. We've made life unbearable for them there. A rational economic plan would try to even out where the development happens, to give benefits and rising conditions to everybody so they can stay where they are, don't need to make the trip, don't need to become unwanted immigrants. That would be a rational way to deal with this situation. Punishing the immigrant is punishing the victim. It doesn't solve the problem because we've been doing that for 150 years and it never solved the problem. And it isn't going to solve it now. Conditions drive this event. That has to be the lesson learned if you want to take seriously the economics of immigration. We've run out of time. Thank you very much. And I hope that next week at Economic Update, you will rejoin me again.
You'll trying not to behave. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, babe.
Good morning. The time is 9:59. Stay tuned at 10:15 for Flashpoints. Today on the show, journalist and author Vijay Prashad discusses the Israeli-Egyptian ceasefire fakeout and the real politics behind the U.S.-supported Israeli bombing in Gaza. Also more on the corporate media's pro-Israeli reporting. At 11 o'clock on the food show, Paul Greenberg talks about his book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Also, stories from Chehalem Valley winemakers and a discussion about seaweed and radiation. All that coming up on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. It's just about 10 o'clock and time for Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning in today.